We're continuing with this long chapter called Unsupported and Unsupportive Consciousness. Here are a couple of passages from the scriptures that give a little more background to the mental qualities that Ajahn Chah is describing. That account of him hearing the sound of the festival in the village was the last thing we were looking at yesterday. That separation of the quality of awareness and the objects of awareness was what Lumpo Cha was speaking about, and the contrast where he said before there used to be continuity, santati, between things. When that's broken, when things are not, say, attached to, or the mind is not entangled with things, then there is santi, peace. So Lumpo Cha is very fond of word plays, so that alliteration between santati and santi was part of what he was drawing upon there. So this next passage is from the Book of the Elevens, the Numerical Discourses. It's from the Sutta number 9 of the Book of the Elevens. So the Buddha is speaking to a monk called Sandha. There is the case, Sandha, where for a superior person, the perception of earth with regard to earth has ceased to exist. The perception of water with regard to water, perception of fire with regard to fire, the perception of air with regard to air, these have all ceased. The perception of the sphere of infinitude of space with regard to the sphere of infinitude of space, the perception of the sphere of infinitude of consciousness with regard to the sphere of the infinitude of consciousness, the perception of the sphere of nothingness, no thingness, with regard to the sphere of no thingness, the perception of the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception with regard to the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception, the perception of this world with regard to this world, the perception of the next world with regard to the next world. Whatever is seen, heard, sensed, cognized, attained, sought after, pondered by the intellect, the perception with regard to even that has ceased to exist. Meditating in this way, the superior person meditates dependent neither on earth, water, fire, wind, the sphere of infinitude of space, the sphere of the infinitude of consciousness, the sphere of nothingness, the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception, this world, the next world, nor on whatever is seen, heard, sensed, cognized, attained, sought after, or pondered by the intellect. And yet, they do meditate. And to this superior person, meditating in this way, the gods, together with Indra, the Brahmas, and their chief queens, pay homage even from afar. And then the Buddha recounts the kind of homage or praise that these deities would give to such a one meditating in that way. Homage to you, O superior one. Homage to you, O superlative one, of whom we have no direct knowledge, even of what it is that you meditate dependent upon. So we don't know what it is that you've realized, but it's really great. So sātu, sātu, sātu. It's interesting in this sutta, what's translated here as superior person, the translation Bhikkhu Bodhi has is thoroughbred. And throughout the sutta, there's these references to horses. And the Buddha says, don't be like a colt, like a young, foolish horse, so that when it's brought beside the food trough, it thinks, fodder, 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 like eat, eat, eat. Now, instead, the thoroughbred person will stand by the food trough and consider, I wonder what my master has in store for me today. What task is there for me to carry out? I looked it up in the Pali Dictionary of Proper Names, who Sandha might be, but there's very, very little information, or hardly any at all, there. But there's so many references to horses in that sutta. My suspicion was that Sandha might have been a horse trainer before he was a monk, or maybe someone who was in the cavalry in the army, because the Buddha's going on and on about horses, and a thoroughbred person, a thoroughbred meditator throughout that. So the thoroughbred, for those of you who might not be aware, all racehorses are what they call thoroughbred. It means you're from a very particular lineage. So a racehorse, nowadays, they have their ancestry designated of who the father was, who the mother was, all the way back to three primordial stallions back in the 18th century. Nowadays, that's what thoroughbred means. In the Buddha's time, it would have meant a really fine horse that's well-trained, let's say, responsive in a thorough way to the instructions of the rider. there any questions, thoughts on that particular sutta? So it's sutta number 9 from the Book of the Elevens, if you want to look that up. Yes?
My impression is this comprehension of the separation between the sense objects and, you know, the mind objects seems to be able to happen at all sorts of different levels of acuity, because like what you're reading there, that'd be Nibbana, you know. And the Ajahn Chah passage, if my recollection is correct, if you read further, you know, he has the experience of the whole world exploding, so that it was no minor thing that he was doing. But again, I think one can usefully contemplate that at much lesser levels of acuity as well.
With many aspects of Dhamma, just getting the concept, getting a picture for the possibility, just as an idea, there can be that kind of, as you say, with the perception of earth with regard to earth, that perception has ceased to exist or ceased to be substantial. So just having the idea of that, just hearing the words, reading the words, just that much is a step in the, as it were, right direction. Like, oh, that's possible, my goodness. And so in terms of varying degrees, I would say that there can be moments in the practice or along the way where the mind can have that, at least a momentary realization of that quality. The word exists in English. The word exists. In English, the etymology is from the Latin existere, which means to stand out from. Ex means out, or like the exit is the way out. So that which stands out. And so when it's saying that the perception of earth with regard to earth has ceased to exist, it's like that imagery of it's not standing out, or it's not taken as solid, substantial, and absolute. That's, I think, a good way of understanding it, or relating to it. One of the most wonderful teachings of Ajahn Panyawado, who was a senior Western student of Lungtang Mahabua, is very worthy of contemplation. He says, the five khandhas exist, but they're not real. The Dhamma is real, but it doesn't exist. The Dhamma does not stand out, but it's real. The five khandhas stand out, you know, form, feeling, perception, so on, but they're not real, they're not substantial. So just that one phrase, I feel it's extremely insightful, brilliant expression to reflect on that, really let that into the heart. Because in ordinary use of the word existence or something existing, we take that to mean, yeah, it's a real thing. It exists, it's actual. But in that way, Venerable Panyawado highlights it in that way. I think it's a very, very clear way of reconfiguring that understanding of the word exist or existing as that which is standing out, that which is apparent, that which is tangible. Any comments on that?
I think it's a good point to make that sense of we don't have to always be thinking in terms of ultimate realization, but that the principles exist at all the different levels of how we practice or how we live, how we engage with the world around us. I think that's scale and variance.
Yes. Many years ago, I had a dream where Master Hua appeared. He didn't speak much English, but he spoke very good English in this dream. It's kind of handy. Ajahn Chah has spoken English in my dreams as well. Extremely useful.
That's very helpful.
Very helpful. And enough of a dream not to recognize, hang on a minute, he can't speak English. But anyways, Master Hua appeared in this dream, and the words that he said were, bright, loud, and mobile is the false. Subtle and indistinct is the true. Kind of reflects the same kind of area. Any other thoughts, questions? Yes.
I also contemplated, I have one habit of engaging, watching Hollywood kids, what is going on in the world. And when I decide not to engage in it, it ceases to stand out. It ceases to be a reality for me. And then there's peace. And as soon as I re-engage and make that part of my reality again, and I can decide if I engage with that or not. So that, like, what an ordinary level, you know, can experience that.
Yes, thereby hangs a tale. It's a quote from Shakespeare, which means that's indicative of how things are in the world. It's a pun that Shakespeare's using. It means there's a story associated with that that we can learn from. Okay, so to continue. Now, the Venerable Ananda went to see the Blessed One, and on coming to him, saluted him and sat down at one side. So seated, he said this to the Blessed One. Venerable Sir, may it be that a bhikkhu's attainment of concentration is of such a sort that in earth he does not perceive earth, in water he does not perceive water, in fire he does not perceive fire, in air he does not perceive air. In the sphere of infinite space he does not perceive it, in the sphere of infinite consciousness he does not perceive it, in the sphere of nothingness he does not perceive it, in the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception he does not perceive it. That in this world he does not perceive this world, in the world beyond he does not perceive the world beyond, and yet, at the same time, he does perceive. That's Venerable Ananda's question. The Buddha responds, it may be so, Ananda. A bhikkhu's winning of concentration may be of such sort, and then he repeats all those details, with the final part of it being, and yet, at the same time, he does perceive. Then Ananda asks, but, Venerable Sir, in what way may a bhikkhu's winning of concentration be of such a sort that he still does perceive? Herein, Ananda, a bhikkhu has this perception. This is the real. This is the best. Namely, the stilling of all formations, the abandonment of the substratum of existence, the ending of craving, the fading of desire, cessation, nibbana. In such a way, Ananda, a bhikkhu's attainment of concentration may be of such a sort, again with all those descriptions, and yet at the same time he does perceive. So that's in the Book of the Tens, also the Numerical Discourses, Sutta number 6. So it's very, very closely related to that dialogue with Sunda. That series of qualities we've come across three or four times already in these readings. So this is the real, this is the best. The stilling of all formations is sabba sankhara samato. The abandonment of the substratum of existence is sabbupadi patinitsago. The ending of craving, tanha kaya. The fading of desire, viraga. Cessation, nirodha, and then nibbana. That's a familiar string of qualities. And so when Ananda said, well, when the mind has let go of all of that thingness, it's not identified with even those subtle states of concentration, what is the mind aware of? And it's aware of, this is real. This is the best. But again, as I was saying a few readings ago, when it spells this out in words, you know, this is the real, this is the best, etc., etc., it doesn't mean necessarily that the mind is repeating those words or that it's forming a concept around that, but there's the appreciation of that set of qualities, even if the mind isn't going into a verbal description about that. Because these are suttas, they're words, so they're using words to talk about particular qualities, but I feel it's helpful to recognize that there can be that quality of peacefulness or realization, that attunement of the jitta, the heart, to reality, and that can be fully known, appreciated, without the mind saying, oh, here is the jitta fully appreciating the real. It doesn't have to be spelled out in a languaged way. Oh, any further questions, thoughts? Please don't be shy. These readings, I keep saying, reminding people, these readings are for you, so if things are unclear, then...
Did you happen to know what the Pali was for this is the real, this is the best?
I didn't look that up, but I can do. No, you can look it up on your phone. Book of the Tens, Sutta number 6.
Yeah, because usually that phrase is etam santam, etam panitam. This is peaceful, this is sublime. Mm-hmm. So I'm just curious if there's other iterations like that, and then what it is.
Yeah, it might be that, but there could be some variation.
Right, it'd be interesting.
So, Book of the Tens, Sutta number 6. Yes?
Following up on what you were saying about Pali and the way, my understanding is that in English, a direct quote, we say, she thought, comma, then a direct quote, then the end of that. Mm-hmm. Pali often does not require that verb in there. It it will launch right into a quote. There's no indication of whether it is spoken or thought or how it is cognized.
Mm-hmm.
And so that may make it easier to express something like what you're saying in Pali, where you can break into a quote without having to specify that it's being thought.
Yeah, English has got a lot of clutter in that way. Yes?
Is what you're describing, is it something that somebody might arrive at in their ordinary waking?
Well, as with many things, it can be in some unguarded moment, just brushing your teeth. Suddenly the mind can recognize, oh, I call this a toothbrush. Oh, it's not really absolutely a toothbrush. I mean, this is the way that things can work. Sometimes if we're quite tired or we're just sort of not paying attention, we get distracted. So it's a kind of, in a way, a glitch in our habitual world-making and judging process. It's sort of like a, if you remember vinyl records, when the, if the needle skips. Those of us who remember vinyl records and needles. So it skips. It doesn't necessarily take place in the quiet of the meditation hall, which can do, obviously, and particularly, I would say, with the development of vipassana meditation, insight meditation, the effort is to clarify that quality of awareness. But from time to time, it can be in those sort of unbidden moments where, literally with the toothbrush, suddenly, this is not a toothbrush. Oh. I mean, not that toothbrushes are sacred, but I'm just using a random example.
Like a vivid sense.
Yeah, just suddenly the mind just frames things in a different way, or its usual world creation glitches. Just feeling the weight of your body on the ground, suddenly that just that feeling of being pulled to the earth. It's like, oh, this is the feeling of weight. Oh, what's that? The usual habitual processes are just interrupted. I'm not praising distraction per se, but often it's in those sort of unbidden moments, like the famous moment of Venerable Ananda's enlightenment is when he gives up on the meditation. He thinks, oh, well, I've been up all night trying to realize full and complete enlightenment so I can go to the big meeting today. The first council was about to happen, and he was told by Mahakasapa he couldn't come unless he was an arahant. No pressure. And the expectation was he was going to recite all the Buddha's teachings, but he was, quote-unquote, only an anagami. So he stayed up all night doing sitting and walking meditation, trying to realize complete enlightenment so that he could meet the requirement to come to the meeting. And he sees the dawn coming, the sky is getting lighter, and then he has this train of thought, oh, well, you know, I've been working the hardest I can all night long. I haven't realized the end of suffering. And putting words into his mouth, it's going to be a long day, I might as well take a rest. So it said that as he gave up on the meditation, and as he sat down on the platform, the bench, after his feet left the ground, before his head met the pillow, he realized full and complete enlightenment. So it's when he gave up the practice, also gave up the formal meditation, that was the moment of the great breakthrough. So he earned the recognition of being the one person to be enlightened outside of the four postures. He wasn't sitting, standing, walking, or lying down. So that shift of view, and it depends what we make of it. If we don't have a framework for that, it can just be something that we think we're going crazy or we're freaking out. Oh, one example that people mentioned from time to time is seeing your face in a mirror and it's not your face. It's like it's nobody else's face, but the sense of that being me suddenly sort of glitches and it's like, oh, this which is aware of that face hasn't got a face. If that's not me, what am I? So without a framework of Buddha Dhamma or Dhamma teachings, then that can be a real freak out. And it's like, I'm going crazy, or I put the kettle on, or see the doctor. But if there's a framework for recognizing, oh, I only call that my face because of conditioning, but how could the quality of awareness have any shape or form? Awareness doesn't have a face, never did. Oh, of course. But if we don't have a framework or a context for that, there can be a serious freakout. Don't want to deal with that, so you find some help, some psychological help, or you find a distraction or something to get away from that. It's paying attention to those moments and being ready to learn from them. Then it helps to reveal and underscore the fabricated nature of perception, that it's not anything absolute or permanent. So that's why I like to recommend, as I often have done, books like The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat by Oliver Sacks and other books by him. He's a neurologist, a neuroscientist, a psychiatrist. So collections of different pathologies that people experience. So it's a kind of popular science book, but by the time you get to the end of the book, you really don't trust perception. You realize, oh, this is really very delicately fabricated and held together, and it can glitch in all sorts of different ways. So that habit of taking the world of our sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and thoughts as being absolutely real, it's like, oh, well, that's not reliable. This is fabricated and formed. These are not something to believe in or to follow. It's a different angle of approach. I got a bit of a scientific bent, but I find shifts the view that you are the world that you think you're in. Another example is Ajahn Kurunadamo, to go back to the States. He is completely red-green colorblind. So when you say, this is red, he'll say, if you say so. You know, they are different shades of sepia, of brown. And I said, well, how did you learn to drive the traffic lights? And he said, they're always in the same order. Yeah. But he can't see the difference of the color. So, is this really red? Or is it red because of the conditioning of our particular forms of eyesight, assuming that you're not colorblind? Just bearing that in mind. Oh, my mind is creating redness and greenness and so on. It's not intrinsically absolutely there. It's because of the receptivity of these sense organs can pick that up. His can't. So every so often we'd have to explain, oh, this is a really nice flower arrangement. Yeah, if you say so. When he was a layman, he purchased a Honda Civic that he thought was quite a subtle, kind of modest chase. He's a very humble guy. He's not a flashy kind of a person at all. And his partner didn't tell him that it was electric green. He just kind of... That's what partners are for, you know. So he was driving this kind of very kind of...
It's very flattering.
Very wow. Kind of wow-ish color, like electric kind of fluorescent green Honda Civic around. And that became the Abhayagiri Monastery car for a while. That was our first car. It was Anagarika Tom, as he was in Anagarika Tom's Honda. We'd had it for a while, and I asked him, so what made you buy a car like this? And he said, well, Bill didn't tell me that it was electric green. I thought it was a very modest color. So I feel it's useful to contemplate those things, that the mind creates the world in the particular form that we experience it. It's not absolutely intrinsically there.
It was. Etang Satang, Etang Panitang.
This is peaceful, this is...
This is sublime.
Panitang superior. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Superior. The best.
I mean, in Thai, it's just rani, it's sort of refined, you know. It's obscure. But it is sabbasankara, sabbata, sabbupadi, but it is about the stilling of formations, the relinquishing of the acquisitions. But it starts off... To me, it's interesting. It's a stock phrase that's consistent. Yeah, this is peaceful, this is sublime. To me, it's I've contemplated that, and just tears coming to my eyes.
Okay, continuing. The experience of meditating at night in the forests of Thailand, whilst the sounds of raucous activity from the nearby villages fill the air, is a very common one. Even today... complete with PAs that carries even further than it used to. Ajahn Chah often referred to another similar insight which arose on one such occasion. As in the previous story, he was endeavoring to practice meditation, but at this earlier time, he was becoming irritated by the noise. So he's sitting up outside of a village, hearing the sound of the merrymaking, the festival going on in the village, which they usually have their festivities at night time when it's sort of cooler, and they're working during the day. So Lumpo Cha is describing his train of thought. Why do they waste their time doing unskillful things and make disturbance for everyone else into the bargain? Don't they know there's the monk out here in the woods trying to meditate and practice the Buddha's path? I go into the village every day for alms. They know I'm here. They should know better than to be so insensitive. They're making lots of bad karma, etc., etc. Suddenly, amidst the flow of righteous indignation, he realized the sound is just sound. It's only doing its duty as sound. It has no intention to annoy me. Why should I go out and annoy it? If I leave it alone, what harm can it do me? Upon this realization, his mind became very peaceful, even though the sounds of the village festival were still there. In a similar vein, here's a passage from the teachings of Lumpu Dun, another of the great forest ajans that was a disciple of Lumpu Man. We were talking about him earlier. He had a monastery in Surin. So this is from the collection of teachings and stories about his life, called Atulo, which is his Pali name, collected teachings compiled by Bhikkhu Bodhinandamuni. Lumpu lived at his monastery in Surin for 50 years without spending a rains retreat elsewhere. It is in the middle of the town, and because of that, it's quite noisy, especially during occasions like the Elephant Festival or New Year. It can be a week or two of constant impingement. For any of the monks and novices who are not firm in their practice, it can be quite disrupting. Whenever anyone would complain, Lumpu would instruct, "Why are you bothering to take interest in such things? It's ordinary for light to be bright. It's ordinary for sound to make noise. That's its duty. If we don't take an interest in it, it stops right there. Look after yourself so that you're not an enemy to the circumstances that you're in, because the circumstances are just that way. That's all. Just see things with true wisdom, and that's enough." That's a very regularly quoted teaching, and the example also from Lumpu Cha's life, the very, very regularly quoted evening at the Hampstead Vihara when Lumpu Cha was visiting England, and across the road was the Hampstead, was the Haverstock Arms. It's on Haverstock Hill, this very popular pub with loud rock music playing. And it was during the summertime, when there's rare hot summer evenings, and people had heard that this great master was visiting from Thailand, so they'd come to the Vihara, which had a very, very small shrine room. So lots of people were squished into this small space. Lumpu Cha was leading the meditation, you know, silent meditation practice. And so they sat there with the window closed, trying to keep all the music out. And so then it became really hot and stuffy. So then be a sort of shuffling around, and then the sound of the window being opened, then the music would be really loud. And then there'd be loud music for a few minutes, and then shuffle, 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 window being closed again, then the room getting hot and stuffy, and then the window being opened again. And so Lumpu Cha let that go on for an hour and a half, apparently. I was not there. I was about a mile away doing my final exams at college when that happened. Lumpu Cha let that go on for an hour and a half. And when he rang the bell, he said, "You think that the sound is annoying you. Rather, it's you going out to annoy the sound." And then saying virtually the same as what Lumpu Dun said here, that if you don't go out and annoy it, it won't be a problem. But because of the way the mind relates to these things, we take it as an intrusion, as a problem, as a burden. And that duty, is it nati?
Nati.
It's a nati. It's got a bit more of a broad meaning in Thai than in English. When we use the word duty in English, it's kind of a human quality of...
It's function. Hmm? Function.
Yeah. In Thai, it has more of that, yeah, it's its function, its nature, its role, a broader meaning. So. Any questions, comments, thoughts? We had a lot of construction going on for this building during this year. So sitting in the temple various times, we had lots of opportunity to be hearing noises. I think the winter retreat a year ago, there was ample sounds of big machinery. I was impressed how nobody complained, at least not to me. Maybe there was some internal complaining going on, but I was impressed how people could really take this kind of teaching to heart and work with that as a spiritual exercise, because we couldn't really say to the contractors, please stop for 3 months and then pick up again when we're having a more active time. Yes?
I've noticed if it's a noise which I've got absolutely no control over, like a plane flying over, I find it quite easy to leave it alone. But if it's something like, well, actually, if I have a word with that person, I can get them to stop making that noise. But it's harder to...
Yes.
It kind of feels like, well, if I actually say something, then maybe they'll stop. And so that seems much harder practice to...
Even so, friends. The illusion of control is another dukkha maker. How should I say it? When will be the right moment? Lumpur Sumedho used to have frequent comments about people who would wear nylon jackets or a nylon anorak in the meditation hall. And if you listen to some of the old Dhamma talks, even I think in some of the books, the anoraks get quite a bit of mention.
Ajahn, what approach do you take when someone is snoring in the Dhamma hall? Is it a kindness to them to actually wake them, or would you leave it?
Depends on who's snoring. If it's me...
Leave you alone.
Leave me alone, yes. Monks have been known to fall asleep during their Dhamma talks, which is quite an achievement. So joking, not joking, it depends who it is. I think if it's just momentarily, you have a momentary thing, then just say leave it. If it's something that's going on for an extended period, you know, 10 minutes into an hour-long sitting, then it's often a kindness to take action and for someone to gently go up and bring it to that person's attention that they are not quite with it. But it does depend who it is that's dropped into that state. It's not an uncommon situation.
No, it's not.
I'm trying to remember where it was, but I think it was on a 10-day retreat, and one of the retreat managers had a word with somebody who was continually snoring. I'm not remembering this very clearly, but their comment was, I get my best sleep in the shrine room. It was a joking, not joking. It was a kind of a way of apologizing, but like, yeah, I have a really good rest. So to continue. Such detachment, providing, quote, no footing for the flow of experience, is not confined to sense perceptions alone. Very significantly, it also applies to thoughts, moods, and emotions. The Buddha outlines this clearly in the Satipatthana Sutta. So this is the section on what's called jittanupassana, the contemplation of... Well, jitta means the heart or the mind, but this is probably more accurate to say to moods or mind states in that particular... How do you translate jitta and jitanupassana?
I wouldn't translate.
It's broader than moods, but it's not any aspect of mind. Also, an area of teaching that Lumpur Sumedho has spent a lot of time over the years expounding on and encouraging a kind of an understanding of. So this is the third of the four foundations of mindfulness, jitanupassana. And how, bhikkhus, does a bhikkhu abide contemplating mind as mind? Here a bhikkhu understands mind affected by lust as mind affected by lust, and mind unaffected by lust as unaffected by lust. He understands mind affected by hate as mind affected by hate, and mind unaffected by hate as mind unaffected by hate. He understands mind affected by delusion as mind affected by delusion, and mind unaffected by delusion as mind unaffected by delusion. He understands contracted mind as contracted mind and distracted mind as distracted mind. He understands exalted mind as exalted mind and unexalted mind as unexalted mind. He understands surpassed mind as surpassed mind and unsurpassed mind as unsurpassed mind. He understands concentrated mind as concentrated mind and unconcentrated mind as unconcentrated mind. He understands liberated mind as liberated mind and unliberated mind as unliberated mind. In this way, he abides contemplating mind as mind internally, or he abides contemplating mind as mind externally, or he abides contemplating mind as mind both internally and externally, or else he abides contemplating mind in its arising factors, or he abides contemplating mind in its vanishing factors, or he abides contemplating mind both in its arising and vanishing factors. Or else, mindfulness that, quote, there is mind, unquote, is simply established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness, and he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That is how a bhikkhu abides contemplating mind as mind. As I was saying, this is a very significant, it's quite short, that's pretty much the whole of the Jhitanupassana section, but extraordinarily helpful, because it's pointing out that if the mind is agitated, mindfulness is not necessarily getting rid of the agitation, but rather, oh, this is what the agitated mind feels like, or the concentrated mind is concentrated, oh, this is what concentration feels like, it's like this. And it's really noticeable that in this particular sutta, there's no value judgment about wholesome or unwholesome, beneficial or unbeneficial. That's completely left aside. So it's looking with a quality of non-judgmentalism and equanimous wisdom at those different states. Other places he'll talk about lust and anger and hate and so forth as being unwholesome. But in the development of mindfulness and the approach that's being described here, to me, it's really significant. There's no value judgment. It's just, here it is. This is the concentrated mind. It's like this. Here's the lustful mind. It's like this. Here's the mind free of lust. It's like this. Here's the contracted mind. It's like this. Here's the unconcentrated mind. It's like this. That simplicity and directness is a very, very common theme in Lumpo Sumedho's teachings, because he would so often talk about the vibhavatana to get rid of all the unwholesome, unskillful and unwanted states, and the bhavatana, the wanting to become, or the wholesome and good and beneficial states. And it's a whole bhavatana, vibhavatana tangle that gets created in the meditation. But the quality of mindfulness and acceptance towards what's present doesn't mean to say that you like, you know, agitation or contractedness or hatred or lack of concentration, but the very mind that says, here it is, it's like this, is establishing a quality of realistic appreciation of what's present, and that creates a bit more space in the mind. As it says, just to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness, here it is, this is what's present. And that helps the aspects of mind that already recognizes the wholesome and the unwholesome, then they come into play, so following that, as a result of that. This is so significant, so helpful, that I feel it's a particular section of the foundations of mindfulness to really get to know very, very well. Also, speaking of people snoring in the shrine room, in the meditation hall, when it says contemplating internally and externally, there's been many debates, probably a whole PhD theses written about what that means. How do you contemplate concentration externally? What does that mean? Or internally? What is that? So my understanding, what makes most sense, is when it says internally, it's like referring to your life, your mind, and externally, other people. Like contemplating the Kayanupassana is like contemplating the bodies and physical presence of other beings, not just yourself. There is great debate over this interpretation, as there are in quite a few aspects of Satipatthana, and also the Anapanasati Sutta. That's how I can understand it. So, when somebody is snoring in a meditation hall, contemplating unconcentrated mind externally is, oh, that sounds like somebody snoring. That's it. You don't have to add anything to it. That one way of reading that. I'm not sure if Lumpo Pasanda would agree, but...
Oh, yeah. Sometimes the explanation is so convoluted that you just take the most obvious thing and
yes.
How do you apply it?
There's the experience of an irritated feeling arising. It's like this. Yes?
Getting back to the examples you were giving earlier, the external stimulus, bringing the sense of self, I was contemplating how the sense of self tends to show up more in a relational way, when it tends to be towards other people. For example, if it's someone snoring, it's different from an airplane going by.
Indeed so, yes. So
the self seems to be a relational, interpersonal process.
It certainly feeds that. You don't have such a personal relationship with an aeroplane flying overhead. But there can still be the feeling of self, like I'm hearing that plane flying overhead. But it gets exaggerated with that you know the name of the person who's snoring. And it's much more personal. They are doing it again. Don't they know? And it turns into a whole story. Whereas those more sort of ambient sounds, the wind in the trees. I don't know if I've ever heard anyone complain about the sound of wind in the trees around a meditation hall. People have grumbled about Luton Airport and the airplanes going over. But yeah, when it's windy, it's just windy. What are you going to do about it? It's very, very non-personal. But there's still that I feeling of I'm hearing the wind, I'm experiencing the sound of the windy day. The Sakaya Ditti, the sort of self-view, getting much more colourful and exaggerated, that comes with that, as Tanjita Sangaro was saying. When you can do something about it, or you know the person, or there's a relational quality, then that amps up things a lot. It's also an interesting contrast when you do meditation alone and when you do meditation with other people. Because when there's physical solitude, there's not so much that's feeding that relational sense, if you see what I mean. The appreciation of those more subtle kinds of eye-making and mind-making can be more apparent in the solitary retreat time. And then when you're with others, the more personal aspects get stronger. One aspect of solitary practice is just noticing, oh, look at that, there's nobody to be annoyed with except me. There's less fuel for self-view, the habits of judgment and self-view, like and dislike, and that self-creating habit. There's less of an energy source for that when you're by yourself, I would say, in my experience.
So we're contemplating now really practice the four Brahma Viharas. It's more or less a relational practice in the sense that you're cultivating heart's qualities towards others.
Yeah.
And it's very powerful as well,
letting
go of the self.
Yeah, Lumpur Pasana's got a very fine little book called Abundant, Exalted, Immeasurable on the Brahma Viharas. I think we have a few copies here. It's got a completely white cover with the title embossed in it, so you have to look closely to read the title. So he's very qualified to offer some reflections on that. The expression Ajahn Vajiro used for the Brahma Viharas is mature emotions. That I think is a really good way of expressing that. It is about relational qualities, it's about emotional expression, but those emotions that are mature, that are not associated with anything unwholesome or personal in many ways. Anyway, Lumpur, any particular reflections on the Brahma Viharas?
No, I mean, I think it's just not all relations have to be fraught with negativity and self-obsession.
Yes.
So far the examples have been somewhat like passive, but say, for example, you're constantly around someone who unwelcomely engages you with prolonged and agitated discussion. How do you handle that?
With mindfulness and wisdom? Joking, not joking. Rather like the snoring factor, it depends on who that person is. If it's the Ajahn responsible for your training, that's one thing. If it's a fellow Anagarika, that's another thing. It's very situational. With many aspects of Dhamma practice, there's no strict formula. So I was kind of joking, kind of not joking, when you say mindfulness and wisdom, okay, to consider, okay, this is getting a bit burdensome and oppressive, maybe I should say something. What should be said, and what would be a good time to say that? So you reflect on the factors that are playing into it. If you feel it's going to be impossible, or there's some difficulty with you expressing that yourself, then let somebody else know that you're experiencing difficulty with that, and say, could you have a word with so-and-so? I can't say anything without getting really sweaty. And it's not uncommon that a person doesn't realize the negative impact they're having on others. It's just like breathing. There's no recognition that it might be unwelcome or problematic. If you find it's difficult or challenging to express that yourself, then just finding some other way of that being conveyed so it can be received in a non-aggressive, open way. Because it needs to be a communication rather than a declaration. If it's only going one way, there's no transmitter but no receiver, it doesn't help. So there needs to be a receptivity for that kind of feedback to be useful. Any comments you have on that, Lumpur?
Yeah, to think that you just have to be mindful of it and deal with it all the time. And there's it says, like in the Savasana Sutta, the different ways of dealing with the obstructions or the things that create problems for one. And it's not all just by seeing with wisdom. It's like avoiding is one of them. And just trying to separate oneself from the situation. And then certainly in terms of situations like that, then, you know, one of the things that Ajahn Chah said, yes, you definitely want to say something that would be very aware of time and place, like never give feedback to one of your fellow someone is before the meal.
Very important advice. Applies in all dimensions. It's not guaranteed indigestion. So one of the things about mindfulness and wisdom, just to briefly state, is that it can come across as intrinsically passive, but we can be mindful of our own capacity to act. So being mindful, or kind of quote unquote, just watching, doesn't mean not saying anything, not taking action. It's, you know, satipatthana, the foundations of mindfulness, but we can be completely mindful of taking initiative. It doesn't imply passivity, and that's a very, very common misunderstanding. Spend a week on that subject. I feel it's very important that just watching something or being aware of something does not imply passivity. We can just watch our taking of initiative. Our capacity to act is part of the way things are. And sometimes being the watcher, or being the observer, being the one who knows, or the embodying the knowing element can imply a sense of don't say anything, don't do anything, freeze. You know, just like be passive or be numb. That's not the way of the Buddha at all. Being mindful, or being the watcher, being the observer, it includes our capacity to relate mindfully and to take action in situations, and that we can mindfully observe making choices. It's not an intrusion upon peace. Like in T.S. Eliot's poem, The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock, do I dare disturb the universe? You are the universe. I'm not sure why T.S. Eliot phrased it that way. Maybe he was trying to imply that. You think, if I take some action, if I do something, it is disturbing the universe. From the Buddha's point of view, not necessarily. The Buddha did a lot of taking action. He was extraordinarily creative and took a lot of initiative in his life and his bequest of teachings and the Buddha Dhamma to the world, the establishment of the Sangha and so forth. That capacity to choose, to take action, to engage, is not a disturbance to the universe, but we are the universe. If there is mindfulness and wisdom, that isn't being put aside in order to say something or do something. It's the best way in order to act and speak and to engage. As I said, you could spend a whole week on that theme. It's a very, very common misunderstanding. Should I do something or should I just be mindful, Ajahn? It's like, no, no, no. So, experiencing irritated feeling arising. So, how many times do I have to say it's not like that? So let's leave it there for today.